Please be advised this podcast contains content of a graphic, violent nature. It's not appropriate for children.
Her wounds, she died very quickly. Mm-hmm. There was a stab wound to the chest that she bled into her lungs and died. They think within a couple of minutes, thank God, because the struggle was very violent.
Phillip Island, located 90 minutes from Melbourne, is famous for motorsports and wildlife. Though not necessarily in that order, it depends who you ask, really. For some, it's the V8s and the superbikes, but for others, it's the Penguin Parade, when thousands of penguins race up Summerland Beach to their burrows every night at dusk. Like most people, I don't know much more about the island, and that's the way the locals like it. They are a tight-knit community who keep to themselves and very much dislike inquiries into the 1986 murder of one of their residents.
This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb. Come with us as we go beyond the news cycle to find out how people become killers, how people become victims, and what happens next.
There are a lot of names in the first few minutes of this story, but stick with it. It'll all come together for you like Game of Thrones, trust me. It's the story of an extended family at the heart of an insular community and the strange facts that just don't add up to the coroner's finding. Vicky Petratus wrote the excellent book The Phillip Island Murder about the deaths of 23-year-old farmhand Beth Barnard and her employer, 36-year-old Vivian Cameron. Vivian's husband Fergus was allegedly having an affair with their employee Beth. We start this episode with Vicky telling us about Phillip Island from her perspective.
The book came out 5 years after the crime. So the crime happened in September 1986. And so I guess I was investigating it when it was still quite raw for people, being 5 years after. And when the book came out, it was banned on the island. The bookstores refused to sell it. And I heard a rumour that when the book came out, it was featured in there was a full page in the Sunday Age about the story, and the Age was not sold on the island that weekend. So there was it was weird.
It is weird because it was an unsolved crime in their own community. You would think that they would be welcoming of publicity and of people talking about it and thinking about it again.
No. You'd think, but no. What happened was the families that were involved were all quite powerful on the island, and the family, the Cameron family, owned the Phillip Island Grand Prix racetrack. And then Don Cameron was on the local council. So the family were quite powerful and they're really well known. And, you know, the rumours that I heard were that, people that knew the family that were involved with the newsagent and the bookstore refused to stock it.
Can you tell us who these people were before the crime? Who were the Cameron family? Who was Beth Barnard?
The Cameron family lived on the island, and it was a really close-knit community, and they kind of lived within the same street, but not they all had farms. So when I say the same street, it wasn't like they were next door to each other. They were a drive up the road. But they all lived very, very close together, and they had been on the island for many years, and they were very prominent members of the island.
Tell our listeners about what is Phillip Island, what's it all like?
I never went to Phillip Island after the book because crossing over that bridge way back in the early 90s when I was researching the book, it wasn't scary, but you felt like you were being watched. And I'll give you an example. The first time I went to the island to research the book, I went to the local newspaper office and I said to the person at the desk, you know, I want to research what was written about the Phillip Island murder. And so the editor of the newspaper came out and she said to me, you know, who are you? What are you doing? And I explained what I was doing. And she went back to make a phone call, and then she came back out to me and said, I've just contacted the family. They don't want you to write this book.
Wow.
Went, oh, awkward. Mm. So that is literally what happened, when I started researching it. When I also started to find locals who would talk, they were scared. And I guess maybe I didn't pick up on the being scared, because I think as a crime writer, you would know this, Emily, you have to have, you have to have a really thick skin. So I wasn't scared, but people were scared, and people wouldn't meet me on the island. And literally one of the women that I met was on a street corner over the bridge wearing a flower in her buttonhole. This was, so I guess I was really reluctant to go back after the book came out, because you just kind of felt like you were being watched.
It sounds like an evil version of Pauper Spit from Muriel's Wedding. That's how I'm visualizing it right now, I'm sure. Obviously.
I've always got really violence,
yeah, there
was,
evil, but
it was a bit divided, because there were certain people of prominence who didn't want the book to be written, but we were buoyed by the fact that there was a lot of people who were very keen for it to be written, because a lot of people didn't feel that justice had been done.
Well, I guess at the centre of the story, whether or not this man is at the centre of the crime is unknown, and I'm sure there were allegations that we'll come to, but at the centre of the story at the moment are Fergus Cameron, a member of the very high-profile, important family on the island, and a young woman called Beth.
She was from, her father was a QC, and
okay.
So she came from a family in Melbourne, but they, it's my belief that the house that she was murdered in belonged to the family, and that was their holiday house. So she had done, I think a Bachelor of Agricultural Science, and she'd come to the island to work at the Penguin Parade, and she also worked as a farmhand for the Camerons. So, that's how she came to be there. And then when she started the affair with Fergus, that's when everything went downhill for everybody. I think they had an affair for about a year, and the story was that on the night that she died, Fergus had finished work at the Penguin Parade. So he caught up with her all the time at the Penguin Parade as well. And he'd left work at 8, gone round to visit her, got home at 9. His wife and his sister, Marnie, were sitting in the kitchen. They'd rung the Penguin Parade at 8, and they were told that he'd left for the night. And so when he got home at 9, a fight, where have you been? And Marnie left to go back up the road to her place. And according to Fergus, they had a fight and Vivian attacked him with a wine glass, and she smashed it into his head. And then he said he turned around, and then she stabbed him a number of times in his back. So he was injured, and they rang Marnie to come back to look after the children. By the time she came back, they were gone. They were at the hospital. And at the hospital, they were quiet, according to the medical staff. They were quite tight-lipped about what had happened. They didn't talk about what had happened, how he came to be injured. He was stitched up. They came back home. According to Fergus, they discussed their marriage. Vivian, according to Fergus, agreed to leave him with the children and go to Melbourne because he was such a great father and she wasn't a good mother, and that, he and Beth could raise her children. And so then, after they had come to that decision, she drove him to Marnie's house to stay the night. I'm not sure why. And then she returned to their place, and at 3 o'clock in the morning, she's rung a friend and said, I'm at the hospital, could you go and get my kids? Whereas she wasn't at the hospital, that was much earlier. And at 3:30, somebody heard like a Toyota kind of truck driving up near Beth's place in the middle of the night.
Similar to the Toyota Land Cruiser.
Yeah,
similar to Fergus.
Yeah, one of the elderly neighbours said, oh, my son's got a Toyota ute, and it sounded a bit like that.
Okay.
And so the next morning, the friend who had picked up the Cameron children had rung Don Cameron, because she couldn't get on to Vivian and Fergus.
So Don's the patriarch?
So Don is the one on the council.
Fergus' dad?
His brother.
His brother,
his
right.
Brother. You kind of need a family tree, don't you?
I do, but no, I got it so far, yeah.
So Don and Pam That, you know, this friend said, I've got the kids. I can't find Vivian and Fergus. So they then tried to ring, Marnie at her place and couldn't get through. Not sure who was on the phone that early in the morning, but, the friend sent the older child to school and sent the younger child, Don Cameron went and picked up the younger child, the 4-year-old. And then, Fergus, once they finally got on to Marnie and who said that Fergus was at her place, they all became worried because where the hell was Vivian? Why was she ringing someone in the middle of the night?
And saying she was at the hospital when she wasn't.
Yeah. And so then Fergus, not sure why he didn't just ring Beth, but he said to his brother-in-law, so Marnie's husband, Ian, and Don Cameron, he said, could you go and check on Beth? Tell her what's happened. Now, I don't know why he didn't just ring her and tell her what happened, but they drove to her farmhouse. They went in the back door and they found her lying on the floor covered in a doona, and there was she was covered sort of from the nose down and by a doona, and they could tell that she was dead. There was blood and her eyes were open. So they went down to the local police station. It took them, according to the police officer, Cliff Ash, it took them about 10 minutes to tell him that she was dead. So he talked about that, they talked about family fights and family arguments. And finally he said, what are you here for? And they said, oh, we think Beth's not well.
Oh.
Mm.
And so we think she might be dead. So he then drove out to the farmhouse with the two men and another, a young cop called Peter McHenry. And Cliff Ash, given that their complaint was a little bit vague, he went in to check, and he sort of lifted the doona and he could see that Beth's throat had been cut and she'd been attacked quite savagely. And so once the homicide detectives and the local CIB from Wonthaggi got there, it wasn't until the homicide people got there that they lifted the doona and they found a huge A carved into her chest.
Mm. Oh, wow.
And so ostensibly the scarlet letter.
Yeah.
It's an 1850s novel by Nathaniel Hawthorne called The Scarlet Letter. They made a film. Demi Moore was in it.
I'm thinking of Demi Moore just then.
Yeah. And so and it was about the Pilgrim Society in New England,
yeah,
and how a woman was an adulteress and she had a baby out of wedlock and she was forever had to wear a scarlet letter embroidered onto all of her clothing to show that she was an adulteress.
Wow. But the men never have to wear anything.
No.
So where is Vivian? So we've discovered Beth's body. We know where Fergus is. He's at his sister's. We know where the kids are. Where is Fergus's wife, Vivian, by this stage?
That's a very interesting question, Michelle. Vivian, Don and Ian had driven past the Cameron farmhouse to see where Vivian was before they went to Beth's house. And her car was still there, but she wasn't. And so they didn't, no one knew where Vivian was. But here's probably the most interesting aspect of this whole mystery, and I think this is why people still are asking questions. At 10 o'clock that morning, so it happened on the Monday night or in the early hours of the Tuesday morning of the 23rd of September, and at 10 o'clock a local woman called Glenda, she got a phone call from Vivian, and Glenda was in a hurry, and Glenda had a friend who'd come up from Melbourne to stay over. So the friend, Pam, was a witness to this phone call. And the phone call was about, you know, Vivian rang and said, oh, Glenda, have you found out where I can buy a patchwork house for a gift? And so they talked about, cause they both went, Glenda ran patchwork quilting classes. And, so they had this conversation about, you know, I'll ring Diane is there anything else you want, Viv? No, that's fine. And she said, do you want a list of the materials for the patchwork that we're doing? And she said, no, just I'll get them from you at class next week.
Wow.
And then she said, is there anything else? No. But what was really intriguing is that Glenda heard voices in the background and she said to Vivian, are the kids playing up? And Vivian said, oh, no, it's okay now. So she was quite non-committal about what the who the voices belonged to. And then they hung up. And so when Glenda and Pam had gone into town that morning to have a coffee, they heard that there had been a murder. And they couldn't believe it. But it wasn't until on the news that night that Glenda was watching and it said Vivian Cameron, you know, was involved. Now, by that time, Vivian's car had been found not close. No, it was said to be close to the Phillip Island Bridge. But really, if you go over the bridge, there's a milk bar and it was parked opposite the milk bar. So it wasn't parked on the bridge, but her car had been found at, I think it was around 3:30 on the afternoon of the Tuesday, and they found a baker who'd made a delivery that morning saying he'd seen, he said a vehicle, this was kind of a big, I think it's called a Toyota Tray, it's bigger than a ute. I'm not into cars, but it's more truck-like. Mm-hmm. And his statement said, you know, I remember seeing a vehicle there, but he didn't say it was that vehicle. He just remembered seeing something parked there. So from that very vague description, the coroner later concluded that Vivian had driven to Beth's house, killed her, and then driven to the bridge and jumped off the bridge. Now, a couple of problems with that. Well, one of them was the phone call that Glenda Frost got. You know, at 10 o'clock. Another problem was that Vivian's handbag was in the Toyota. So when the friend who came to pick the kids up in the middle of the night, when she came into the house, she saw Vivian's car there and she saw Vivian's handbag there on the kitchen table. So she thought, gee, she must have left in a hurry and she must have gone in, they must have had to ring an ambulance. So she didn't know what had happened, but Vivian's handbag was on the table.
And it later moved.
Well, it later moved. And so, so there's a little bit of discrepancy there. So did Vivian, you know, drive to Beth's, kill her, come home, get her handbag, and then drive back to the bridge and jump off? Or so, you know, aside from that phone call with Glenda and whoever was in the background when Vivian was on the phone, you know, no one's ever reported seeing her
after. And again, in that small community in the morning, it's very active hours, you know, when everyone's up and about getting to work, getting to school, all that kind of stuff. Because I'm thinking, oh, well, she must have phoned from a public phone somewhere, but you would think someone would have seen her. Whoever was talking in the background would have come forward and said that they saw her.
Indeed.
But no one has.
And so, you know, the coroner made a really specific finding a year later that Beth had been killed by Vivian. And then a year after that, he found that Vivian had killed Beth and suicided. So it's one of those things where the evidence didn't really support, or the evidence was, you know, could have been looked at in different ways.
So what makes you think, where does the suspicion come that that is not what happened? Because I can understand that seems to be a pretty logical conclusion to draw from all of the things that happened, that the husband came home, Fergus, they've had an argument, she's realised, or maybe she kind of knew for a little while and it's come to a head that he's having an affair with a girl who works for them. She's attacked Fergus. He's fled to the sister's house, as you do in these situations. I'm going to go and sleep somewhere else. She's gone over and murdered the object of his affection and then freaked out for a few hours, wandered around town, and then killed herself. It sounds like a pretty reasonable chain of events to me.
Absolutely. And when I started to look at the book, you know, look at the story, as the, you know, I was a budding writer and went, oh, this would make a really great book. Mm. That's what I thought it was. And it's not until you started, or I started, to speak to friends of Vivian's who said that one particular friend who I did meet on a street corner, you know, off the island, you know, she said Vivian had said to her just the week before that she knew that Fergus was having an affair and she wanted to leave and take the children to Melbourne. So, you know, everyone that I spoke to that knew Vivian said that she was completely devoted to her children and questioned that she would ever have left them.
Certainly, again, in this situation, it seems hard to believe that a woman would say, I'm going to leave my children with you and your mistress.
Your lover.
Yeah, your lover to raise my children.
I would personally
indeed
do that.
And Beth was, you know, Beth was 23. You know, she was quite young. And Vivian and Fergus were in there, I think Vivian was 36. So it's not something that I think most mothers would be saying, that doesn't really sound likely. But we never had Vivian's side of the story. Yeah. And certainly her family felt that she had snapped somehow. That seemed to be a reasonable explanation. Mm. But when I was researching in the early 90s, Victoria had never on our criminal records had never ever had a case of a woman pursuing the object of the husband's affections. And I think since then we've had the Maria Corp case. Mm-hmm. But, you know, these kind of things are really rare. Women killing women. Yeah. I think we'd had one previous case in Victoria.
And the Scarlet Letter element is a whole other kind of side of it, isn't it? That's odd. It's unlikely for women to attack in such gruesome ways.
It's a brutal murder, wasn't it?
It's brutal, but also they did, decide, or they did discover that Vivian had read the book, The Scarlet Letter, in high school.
It was probably on the curriculum.
Yeah, it probably was. But again, it is an interesting
look. When I looked at the crime scene photos, now the fact that Beth was covered up completely, you could see that Beth was dead. But all of her injuries were covered up. And so, you know, psychologically, if you went to kill your husband's girlfriend and killed her quite brutally and then carved an A into her chest, knowing that your husband would probably be the one to find her, would you then go and get a doona from another room and cover her completely? Or would you just leave her there for... Yeah.
Unless you felt this sudden wave of isn't that something to do with shame when you cover up what you've done, or there's some sort of shame about the relationship with covering a body up?
Yeah, the A was carved, and the A was huge, like it took up her whole stomach, but it was carved post-mortem. And, so that's sort of pretty calculated. And as opposed to the original attack was quite frenzied, and Beth was stabbed a number of times and then her throat was cut, and which also raised the question of was a woman strong enough? So if you've got a 23-year-old farmhand who's, lugging bales of hay, could a woman of 36 who's not as physical have overcome, in a struggle? So that was one thing. Beth was attacked in her bed. She was well known for locking her doors. So how does an attack occur in a bed? It wasn't at the door. She hadn't opened the door for anyone. No one had broken in. The dynamics of the attack were odd as well. And I guess another thing that made things a little bit murky in terms of evidence was that the homicide investigation takes place, all of the interviews take place over about a week after it happens, but the analysis took place a month later, like it took a month for all of the blood analysis. Now, what they found was that Beth and Fergus were both type O, and this is pre-DNA analysis. Yeah. But they both had... I'm not an expert and I might even be pronouncing this wrong, but there's a subgrouping within, they were both type O, but then there's this phosphoglucomutase, and I'm probably not pronouncing that properly, but, Beth was like, she was 1 and he was 2-1 or something like that, so that they could tell the difference between blood from him and blood from her.
Yeah.
And Vivian was type A. They knew that from the hospital records. So what happened was, they found Fergus's blood was on a shirt in the laundry basket and on some tissues in the Cameron bathroom.
Right.
So he talked about when he'd been attacked. Mm-hmm. But he said after Vivian attacked him with the wine glass that he had gone into the spare room and sat on the bed. And so there was blood in the spare room. There was blood splattered on papers in the spare room. There was blood on a face washer. And there was quite a lot of, it looked to me like arterial blood, but the expert said it wasn't. But, you know, like it wasn't just one or two droplets. It was kind of like a spray. Now, that was later found to be type A. So it was Vivian's blood wasn't Fergus's blood. So the blood trails, you know, match the story. So going into the spare room, sitting on the bed, there was blood on the bed. But once that blood was analysed, it wasn't his blood. Now,
up until that point, there'd been no suggestion that Vivian had been injured, had there?
No. And in fact, in Fergus's statement, he said she was not injured and at no time was she struck. Wow. But there was a lot of type A blood around their house.
After the break, we'll find out what happened when the Sensing Murder team looked into the case. Coming up on Australian True Crime, Vicky tells us about the day she saw the crime scene photographs associated with the case. But first, the surprising thoughts of the Sensing Murder team.
Rhonda Burns, who wrote The Secret, so she became very big for The Secret, but before she did that, she did about 7 episodes of Sensing Murder, and she started off with the Easy Street murder, and then that rated over the top, so she was commissioned to do another 6. And so she rang me. I still don't know to this day how she got my number, but she rang me and said, have you got any ones that aren't solved that we could get psychics out? Now, whether you believe in psychics or not, is another thing. But
in a previous episode, we talked to a family who had done an episode, and in fact, it was never aired because someone had put out an injunction against it and all that kind of stuff. But they were very impressed with their experience with the show. These are family of a victim. So,
look, I know people who speak to dead people. So you know. Whether you believe it or not, but anyway, so I was quite fascinated. I guess every crime writer wants the answer, and so when she said she was going to get a bunch of psychics in, I'm like, oh, I'm fascinated to see what they would say. And so anyway, they did the episode. And it was fascinating because all of the psychics stood outside of Beth's house and they all said, this is staged. That was my gut feeling that, it wasn't what it appeared to be. The doona didn't match in my way of thinking with someone who wanted to say, here, take that. Mm. And in fact, Fergus in his statement said that Vivian had said to him, I'm going to go and get that little bitch, you know, and it didn't. And if that was the case, it didn't make sense. But what Rhonda found, she did her own analysis of the evidence. And what she found was that one of the papers on the spare bedroom at the Cameron house, had Beth's blood on it. Mm. Now that was seen, by Fergus's sister Marnie when she came to mind the children before Beth died.
Wow.
This is like
before
really
Beth
intriguing
allegedly died. This is why I'm it like, was cool. murky. This yeah. is why it was murky. So
in the chain of events then is
so Fergus had gone to visit Beth.
Yep.
He had then got home late.
Mm-hmm.
Vivian, according to Fergus, attacked him. They went off to hospital. But when they went to hospital, Marnie came to
Pick up the kids
or mind the kids.
Mm-hmm.
And
she observed
said,
that piece of paper
I
then.
Saw blood on the spare room on the bed and I saw blood on papers.
Wow. And now later and we find out that some of that was Beth's.
Yeah. So, you know, people say to me, what happened? I go, I don't know. I don't know a scenario
threats,
that fits. And I guess having this is my first true crime book. Mm-hmm. I think you expect it to be like TV, where everything at the end is all neatly tied up and every question is answered. And this book taught me that none of your questions are answered. But also,
I think we tend to apply common sense to scenarios where people are out of their minds.
You know,
we go, oh, you wouldn't do that, you would do that. But then I think there's people listening going, oh, when you find out your husband's cheating on you, you'd be amazed what goes through your mind. You're not yourself, you know.
Was the affair known in the community? I mean, Vivian may have come to know, but was it known that Beth and Fergus were seeing each other?
I got the feeling from talking to Beth, talking to Vivian's friends, was that this wasn't the first time it would happen, that she had said if it wasn't Beth, it would be somebody else. Mm. And shortly after Beth died and Vivian vanished, it was somebody else. So, you know, I didn't get the feeling from Vivian's friends that her anger was directed toward the other women. It was directed toward her husband.
So are you saying that Fergus moved on to another lady shortly after?
Yes.
His wife died and Beth died?
Yeah.
Okay. Wow. So is there some suggestion then that Beth was dead by the time Fergus got home that night?
Look, that was never ever suggested, but...
How did her blood get to his spare room?
Well, it's a question, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's one of those unanswered questions.
Yeah.
But the time of death could never be established. And I think in the TV, you know, when they say they find a body and they say, yes, she died at 12:15, you know, that never happens in real life. And by the time, you know, Beth's body was found early the next morning, you know, she had been dead for some time, but there's never a suggestion of time of death, or they could say that the, and look, thankfully her wounds, she died very quickly. Mm-hmm. There was a stab wound to the chest that she bled into her lungs and died. They think within a couple of minutes, thank God, because the struggle was very violent. Mm. But, you know, the coroner was a country doctor, and or the pathologist rather, and he couldn't say, you know, in terms of times of death. He felt that the stab wound happened early on, and that the A was a post-mortem injury, but, you know, there's none of that sort of forensics of TV.
I know police are frustrated by our sort of belief that DNA solves everything now, but I do, you know, I look at some photos, a bloody tissue found at the scene of the murder, the killer believed to have smoked some cigarettes, as an ashtray with cigarette butts. Do you think if this crime had happened today, they would have been able to get further with the investigation with the DNA?
The interesting thing with the evidence in this case was that almost all of it was very portable, so that, you know, they found a towel, a hand towel with A-type blood at Beth's place. But, you know, could that have been brought in?
Hmm.
One thing that the principles of detection, in every crime writer knows this, that in, you know, 1910, Edmund Lockhart came up with his principles of transference, so that every contact leaves a trace. I think that's 101 crime investigation. And the thing about it was that the Land Cruiser found near the bridge had no... You know, Vivian would have been covered in blood. She was last seen wearing a mohair jumper, and you can't, you know, grab some. Literally, Beth was grabbed around the head, and someone had cut her throat from behind, kind of like slaughtering an animal.
Yes, very much so.
And so there was no trace of mohair. There was not one mohair fibre on Beth's body. There was none of Beth's blood in the Land Cruiser. So, you know, you look at contact and trace. If Vivian Cameron walked into a police station today, would she be convicted on forensic evidence? And so while there was a bit of A-type blood, which I heard was later DNA tested and found to be Vivian's, you know, was that put there? If those psychics, if they were right and it was staged, everything could have been done afterwards. Now, when you've got a murder and a missing woman and a missing Land Cruiser, like they're big, you know, trucks, and, you know, what you have to believe is that the police from Wonthaggi and the detectives from Melbourne drove past that truck all day. And so when you're keep a lookout for, you know, that Calof, keep a lookout for a truck, and it didn't, that didn't occur to me until I knew that they had driven past it all day, if indeed it had been there all day. But it didn't occur to me the unlikelihood of that when you've got trained detectives that could drive all drive past it when they've got a keep a lookout for.
And your cops, you're you know, on the beat, cops are used to looking around their environment, and especially in Phillip Island and Wonthaggi, it's country. They'd know, you know, you'd be able to spot something amiss, wouldn't you?
And they'd all driven past it if it was there all day. And it was found that 3:30 that afternoon by one of the Cameron family had driven home from work and went, oh, that's Vivian, that's Fergus's Toyota.
Just sounds a little bit too convenient.
And now
I'm allowed to say that.
Well, it's just so much of what you said at the beginning of the conversation is now, you know, making sense to me.
And the thing about it is when I went to get a publisher, and it was published by a guy called John Kerr, and he read the story and he said, look, it, the thing about this story is it doesn't really have a satisfactory ending. According to the police, it does. They are not investigating it because the coroner found that Vivian killed Beth and Vivian killed herself. So it's not an open investigation. But he said, you know, it doesn't really have a good ending. But what neither of us realised was that the fact that it didn't have a satisfying or satisfactory ending meant that for the last 30 years, people have played armchair detective with this. So I still get contacted today. You know, I'll get an email from someone or someone will contact me through social media saying, I've just read this story. What the hell? You know, and people have come up with theories.
One thing that really I was thinking about when you were describing about the possibility that the scene seems staged, according to the clairvoyance, was that's a pretty hard way for a woman to murder another woman. And as you said, it, physically wise, from the photos, Beth looks like she's a really strong, you know, young woman, very robust. And it just seems like a difficult way to murder someone if you're a, you know, woman.
It was really, really violent. And for me, being a, you know, budding true crime author and having to look at those photos, it was really, really brutal.
That is intense. I can't imagine looking at real crime photos like that.
I think it was the moment that I sat at the coroner's court, because in the, I don't know whether you still do it, and I haven't done it since, but, you know, you could ring them and say, I want to look at this file, and they'd pretty much put you in a little room with the file. And I think it was that at that stage, because, you know, I'm not a journalist, I'm not a writer, I'm a, you know, at that stage I was a primary teacher just with an interest in wanting to be a writer and having to look down at these photos and saying, right, you've got to put on your big girl pants, and if you want to do this, this is part of the job, and you have to put those feelings aside. And I've had to do that many, many times since, but you have to put the feelings of horror aside, and this becomes part of the story.
What became of everybody in the story after this? What did Beth's family make of the ruling?
Look, the families would not talk to me when I was writing the book.
Beth's family even?
Beth's family wouldn't. Okay. And I think that I understand that, because I think how do you, you know, how does that story even play out? You know,
she was so young, and
she was
lost
so
their
young, and how do you sort of talk to people about? Oh, my daughter was killed by the wife of the guy she was having an affair with, and had an A carved into her chest. How does that conversation even happen? And I found that since many, many times, that when you have a child, an adult child, you know, die in a violent way. You know, if it, like I had an uncle who died of a stroke, you know, so that if you go to work and go, oh, my uncle had a stroke and, you know, he's on life support and he's not going to make it, you know, everyone else goes, oh, that happened to my nana and that happened to my grandpa. And, but when you go to work and say, oh, my daughter was killed on the way home from school by a serial killer.
Yeah.
That's a real conversation stopper. It is, and no, yeah. You don't.
And simple questions can lead to it too. How many kids have you got? Interactions can lead into really awkward situations where you have to tell people that your child's been murdered.
I guess the big question now is, should we start a petition to bring back Sensing Murder? I think we all really loved that show. Vicky's book, The Phillip Island Murders, can be hard to track down in paperback form, but it is available as an ebook and well worth the read. Thanks so much for your help in growing the listenership of Australian true crime, particularly in the US and the UK, which is very exciting. I hope you can understand our accents. We love hearing from listeners on Facebook too, so please keep visiting us there and sharing our posts. We'll be back next week with another episode.